first question I want to kind of get to this evening is, I think part of the elephant in the room that we're all kind of wondering about, in light of Thomas Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, or David Berlinsky's The Devil's Delusion, what's the future of neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory? Will it be able to hold its current status and overbearing narrative in the academy and in culture, or do you see it turning around? Is it going to be, is there a significant challenge going on here?
last time he did that on stage, I told him if he did it again, I was going to shoot him. But he's the one who's got the gun, not me. I'll just offer a question about the future of Darwinism, etc. This isn't my specialty, but I rub shoulders with some of the guys who know a lot about this, and it's really clear on the higher levels of the academy, or in the research field, not so much in the academy where students are being taught, that they are moving very quickly away from Darwinism as a model of explanation of the variety of life on the planet. And the reason is, as Dr. Axe pointed out in his presentation, is there just so many problems with it. It just doesn't work. Now, he made a comment about what he called, from a paper that he pointed out, that a phrase, Castro, consensus, Castro consensus. And the point of Castro consensus is you can have a consensus as long as you can have a consensus about the wrong thing if there's no opportunity to disagree. And that was Castro consensus. And this is the situation right now. The community has, the scientific community has a lot invested in evolution, all right, or in some materialistic explanation. So it's been very, very difficult to pry them away from the Darwinian model. And here I mean the neo-Darwinian synthesis, or the macro evolution model, the molecules to man kind of hypothesis. That idea, not changing finch beaks or a peppered moth changes in colors. These are inconsequential changes, all right? It's the big picture that matters, and it's the big picture Darwinism that is hostile to Christianity, because it is meant to replace God. That's the whole point of it, okay? And now it's hard to pry them away from it, but there is so much evidence against the model that even the hardcore materialists, especially the younger ones, are pulling away, and they're trying to find different paradigms to work with. They are not characteristically going to a theistic explanation, even though the evidence for design is overwhelming. Instead, they're trying to find new naturalistic explanations, okay? And what's interesting, last comment here, is Thomas Nagel, who wrote the book Mind and Cosmos, and the subtitle was something to the order of Why the Neo-Darwinian View of the Universe is Almost, Materialistic View of the Universe is Almost Certainly False. This written by a philosopher who is an atheist at New York University, candidly says he doesn't want to go with a theistic answer. He is still looking for some naturalistic explanation that can include the existence of consciousness, which clearly is not physical. So what you have is a strange situation going on in the field right now. You have more and more evidence that hasn't really worked down to the popular level. So you have the Richard Dawkins and all the crowd are still touting evolution as a fact, all right? And a lot of the skeptical internet atheists are saying that. But in the upper echelons, they're moving away from that because it hasn't worked. The problems are just too big. And Doug Axe is one of the guys who has helped show that strata of thinkers that that's the case. But they're not moving towards God characteristically. They're trying to find some other answer that keeps God out of the picture. And some, like Nagel, are at least transparent enough to admit it.
I think I'm on here. Thank you. Hopefully you can hear me better up here.
I think you said, can you hear me better up here? Is that what?
I'm going to be your monitor. I'm like one of those monitor things.
What?
Those square things on the stage. Okay, this is for Mike.
He can't hear either.
Mike, how do we know that Jesus was an itinerant preacher and that his disciples repeated his sermons? Is that speculation, or is there any data to suggest that?
Well, the Gospels tell us that Jesus was an itinerant preacher. He's just going from town to town to town to town. So he's not a pastor who's speaking in the same church every Sunday to the same congregation, or you could say someone, at least in that cultural context, who is meeting in the same synagogue every week. He's an itinerant speaker. So he's going to be just like all these guys up here. They're going to speak the same message as they go around to all these different towns. He's not going to come up with a new message every time. So he probably had a dozen or so messages that he just kept doing over and over. But that's what an itinerant preacher did back then. You just didn't have to come up with a new message every time. So there would be, we know he's an itinerant preacher because the Gospels illustrate him, narrate him being that way. But, you know, the number of messages that he had, well, you know, we just have to speculate on that.
That's a good point, though, what you're saying, because think about that for a second. I occasionally will contact a witness who is it's been 30 years, and I had to do some digging to find this witness. And this witness will say, yeah, I've never told this to anybody because I was afraid, but now that person's dead, so I feel comfortable saying this to you. Are you willing to testify about it in court? Yeah. But it turns out that this will probably be the third or fourth or fifth time that they have ever told the story by the time we get to trial. On the other hand, there are sometimes witnesses who have told this story for 30 years to anyone who had ears, okay? And so we have a great kind of chain of custody if the story has changed. You'll notice, like with Frank and I, people will say, well, can you give me the notes or the script for your talk? Okay, I don't have a script for my talk. And I used to tease Frank all the time. We do a lot of events together. I said, dude, you realize that your jokes are always the same jokes? One time I was with him, he's getting ready. I know this joke is coming, and he would pause. Like he had a little brain thing there. He couldn't remember what the joke was, and he almost skipped the joke, but he caught himself, and I knew the joke was coming. I actually said it before he said it. So I said to him, I said, do you realize that, man, your talks are like word for word identical? He says, dude, do you know you're the same way, right? And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I am. So it turns out that if you have occasion to have to do this talk over and over and over again, it comes out the exact same way, and you don't need a script to do it. Yep. And I think that's part of the issue here. If it was a situation where we found somebody from antiquity who had never spoken this, had not been commissioned by Jesus as an eyewitness for the purpose of describing what he saw in the resurrection repeatedly from the time I leave here until the time you die, that's a different kind of witness. That's a witness that repeatedly says the same thing over and over again to anyone who has ears. And that's a good witness because it turns out you kind of get, it's ingrained now. I know that talk in my sleep. Frank knows his talks in his sleep.
When you give the talk, I do sleep.
Yeah, very good. I thought you were going to say you knew my talks in your sleep too, which is probably true. Why did I even bring that up? I'm sorry I haven't said anything now.
Anyone else want to chime in on that? Or?
Keep moving.
Okay, this question is probably related a little bit to the first one, and it's directed to John Lennox, so probably all of you can answer it. Since he's not here. All right, so when John Lennox points out how science undermines atheism, what are the counter arguments that atheists offer against that?
Nonsense. That's the kind of stuff they say. They don't really give a direct answer. I've debated Michael Shermer and asked him twice, Michael, if materialism's true and you're just a molecular machine, we're all just moist robots, we're driven completely by the laws of physics, why should we trust anything you say? And he wouldn't answer the question because there is no answer.
This is part of the frustrating aspect of this, on the one hand, is trying to get straight answers to straight questions. Because, and the problem is, which is the good side of this, is that there are no answers to some of these questions from the materialist perspective, okay? If you are a materialist, and that means it's meat all the way down, it's just molecules clashing in the universe, and these things follow a certain pattern. That's why science is, works, by the way, because if you set up the experiment the same way every time, you're going to get the same results. You set up the dominoes in the same way every time, the dominoes are going to fall the same way, okay? That's determinism. All right? And if physicalism is true, that there's nothing but the physical material world, all it is dominoes, okay? And Sam Harris argues that that kind of circumstance is the reality. That is, we are all just a bunch of, Sam Harris is one of the new atheists, we are just a bunch of dominoes falling. But how is it that Sam Harris can argue such a thing when every word that comes out of Sam Harris's mouth is just a sophisticated domino falling? He is saying the things he's saying because he must say those words, since some prior physical state is causing it to happen. That's the self-refuting nature of that kind of claim. And if, and by the way, he also goes down and cashes his check for his royalties once a month. Which, why does he earn those royalties, right? He wasn't the one, he was just following the physical conditions before him to write those words down. And by the way, that's another problem. If it's just materialism, how is it that those words seem to make sense to the other falling domino machines that are reading those words? None of this adds up. None of this adds up. This is why materialism is false, or one of the many reasons. But they won't bite the bullet. And the reason is, and Frank referred to this, he said it's not the head, it's the heart. I think you should point to the knees. It's the knees. They don't want to bend the knees to a sovereign, all right? The self is in charge, as Frank said. They won't bend the knee. That is what's at stake for these people.
But let's be fair, though. I think as an atheist, I would have said, look, all of us believe something to be true with less than a complete evidence set. As Christians, you have open questions. Yet you think you can decide reasonably that this is true. As an atheist, I would have said, I also have some open questions. But I think the evidence points me in this direction, and I therefore can suspend those questions I can't answer, just like you have questions you can't answer. How do I reconcile God's sovereignty versus your free will? That's one of the first questions I'm going to ask God about. But since you cannot resolve that, you can't even agree with each other about that, we have the same kinds of things as atheists that we would say we can't agree about. But we trust that there's enough evidence to point. Now, in the end, I couldn't explain how the universe came into being, why it appears to be fine-tuned, why life came in from non-life, why it appears to be designed, why we have consciousness, free agency, objective moral standards, even a standard of righteousness by which we call something evil. I couldn't answer those questions, but I was okay with holding on to a worldview in spite of those unanswered questions. So just for those of you who are thinking about this, the great thing about the Christian worldview is, yeah, we have unanswered questions, but we don't have those kinds of unanswered questions. Those are the most important questions we can ask in the universe. And I just got uncomfortable with the number of unanswered questions I held as an atheist relative to the number of unanswered questions I now hold as a Christian. In other words, the evidence trail that I lead any jury on, when I get to the end of that evidence trail, I'm asking you to step across and render a verdict across your unanswered questions. That step is much shorter for me as a Christian than it was for me as an atheist.
I think this is what distinguishes you, though, Jim, from Michael Shermer, who's the American Atheist, the Skeptic magazine, et cetera, et cetera. Because when Michael is faced with these kinds of questions, and I debated him for 3 hours on national radio, he kept saying, why can't we just say we just don't know?
Right.
What's wrong with that? And, of course, what's wrong with that is that we have good reason to know the answer he doesn't want to accept. So I think that there are some atheists that are going to be frustrated with not knowing the answers and are going to go further like you did. And others are happy not to know because that allows them to justify the atheism that they want to believe in.
Hey, dig up a question for him.
Oh, jeez. Did you really say that?
I did.
Now that Mike Adams is not with us, you have to do it.
I want to hear from him.
All right. I mean, he wore a sports coat. We have to ask him a question.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Titus, it sounds like you discount the work of guys like David Rohl, who believe the Egyptian-Hebrew synchronization is wrong by approximately 3 centuries. Besides Roll being outside the consensus, what's wrong with his theory?
All right, that's a tough question. not a tough question for me, but a tough one to address. We're going into the weeds here. So the problem with radically revising or changing the historical chronologies for the ancient world to try to fit one particular event into that is that it's going to have a chain reaction on everything else. And so you might come up with something that looks like it fits for the Exodus by moving stuff 300 plus years. But then when you go and you look at other things in the biblical narrative that come after that, they're affected, and suddenly you've lost all sorts of connections. Or you have to come up with very, very tentative or outlandish even explanations. Let me give you one example here. In the book of Kings and also in Chronicles, it talks about a pharaoh named Shishak or Shoshak, depending on how you read the Hebrew, who went to Israel and Judah and attacked and besieged Jerusalem. Now, in Egyptian records, there's a pharaoh, well, more than one, but we're talking about a particular pharaoh named Shoshank. And sometimes he's called Shoshank without the N, Shoshak. Okay, same name. He claims to Israel and Judah, and he defeated all these cities. He lists them on a stone wall at Karnak. All right, so we've got the same name. We've got the same types of events or the same events that are being talked about. It's a pharaoh. In the standard biblical chronology and in the standard Egyptian chronology, they match up exactly. All right, so that seems like a good connection, right? Well, if you move things, then you lose that. So then what do? You got to explain with some other kind of event, another person. Who is that pharaoh? Well, in this new chronology, they say that Pharaoh Shoshank or Shishak is actually Ramses II, okay? Well, the name isn't at all similar. So then you have to, he had the nickname that's kind of like that. And then you got to go, well, let's look at Ramses' record list. And he did do some campaigns, but the things don't just match up. Why did we find the stele of Pharaoh Shoshank at Megiddo, one of the places he destroyed, etc.? So you might gain one thing that I'm going to tell you has a lot of problems anyway. But you're losing many, many other things because of that. So there's no reason to kind of destroy the rest of biblical history and synchronisms when you actually don't have to do that. Because if you watched, for example, the lecture that I gave on the Exodus, and we just go with the historical chronologies, it works.
All right, thanks. This one probably is for everyone here. Actually, you know what? Let's go here. Some teachers suggest that our Ten Commandments and the Great Flood story, are borrowed stories from Hammurabi, I can never end the Gilgamesh. Did I say that right?
Hammurabi.
Hammurabi, okay. How would you respond?
That just the flood stories, or did they say creation?
Well, they're saying the Ten, some teachers suggest.
The Ten Commandments, and okay, yeah. I got it. All right, so for those of you who don't know, the person's referring to the Code of Hammurabi, the Law Code of Hammurabi. So he's got all these laws. It was an early law code. It was not the earliest. There are laws in there that are similar to what we see in the Mosaic Law, but there are many law codes that are similar. We look at our law codes today. We can find similarities. Moses didn't just pick out Hammurabi and copy that. If you put them side by side, they're not exactly the same. You could do that with any of the ancient law codes. You see the Mosaic Law is unique. In fact, it has a lot more distinctives than the others because of the ritual law that is included in there, not just the civil law. So no, Moses didn't just borrow from Hammurabi or some others. I'm sure that he was aware of some of these other ancient law codes, though. As for Gilgamesh, the flood story in Gilgamesh, did Moses just copy that and put it into Genesis? Okay, Gilgamesh actually borrowed a flood story and put it into, well, sorry, not Gilgamesh, but the author of this epic, an earlier flood story. So there are multiple flood stories from Mesopotamia, possibly one from ancient Egypt, one from ancient Greece. What they do is they talk about a flood in way ancient times, and they even talk about a guy who built a boat and was able to be saved from the flood because one of the gods came and told him it was coming, warned him. All right, so there's obviously similarities there with the story of Noah and Genesis. But again, if you put these different Mesopotamian flood stories side by side with the Noah narrative in Genesis, you're going to notice that there are differences. For example, in one, in Genesis, 40 days is the time of the storm. Well, in the Mesopotamian version, it's only 7 days. Some other differences, obviously, you've got polytheism versus monotheism. There are different variants within the Mesopotamian stories. Like sometimes the Noah character built the ark himself. Sometimes he had help from the craftsmen of the city that he lived in or by. So rather than saying Moses directly copied from it, which it's obvious he didn't directly copy, but I would say instead there was an actual flood event. There was an actual person, Noah, who built an ark and survived that. And that story got handed down. And in these ancient Mesopotamian cultures, they recorded it. Over time, they may have corrupted it. They infused their pagan theology into it. So they've got different gods in there, different names of gods. But it's not straight copying, no. And there's enough unique content in Genesis to say that it's Moses's own version, if you will, of the flood. But they had their own versions too, Gilgamesh and so forth. They're just going back to the same event. Which one is correct? Well, that's going to depend on your view of the reliability of Scripture.
Well, look at it this way too. Here's the problem I see.
Hey, hang on. I'm talking here. Okay.
I'll go ahead.
I just have a question.
I'll
rather
go ahead
than
bend my knee to my elder.
I have a question.
To my
elder. Look, when I'm talking, you ought to be taking notes. Okay, now.
Go ahead.
No, I had a question, a follow-on question. Is it possible, Titus, that there was an actual flood and these different stories popped up in different cultures because they all witnessed this flood rather than they borrowed from one another?
I said that maybe not clearly enough.
Okay,
yes.
All right.
That,
see,
I agree with you.
See, if you're always formulating the next thing you want to say rather than listening, you'll miss that,
that
kind of stuff.
All right. That's how I look at it. Yeah, exactly.
Well, look at it this way, too. I mean, how I heard the objection is, okay, we have a story about a flood written by Moses. But before Moses, we see in the timeline, here's the timeline going back, that there's a story that precedes the dating of Moses, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And then we see there's another story that precedes Gilgamesh that is the story that's taken from that. Well, remember, Moses is not an observer of this event. He's not recording it as an eyewitness. We're all three of us pointing back to the event that sits where Mike is, way at the other end. The only question is, that event that occurred over there is recorded by three different people groups. Which of these three people groups has the most reliable scripture? That's the question, because all of us aren't. It's not like Moses was recording this. I saw this. He's recording something revealed to him that happened way before his time. It's over there by Mike. So the question is, which of these three is capturing that story most accurately?
All right, okay. Here's a question that I guess affects us all. With many concerned about climate change, I was watching a documentary that one of the scientists made the statement that the Earth was still recovering from the flood. I found this very profound, and it made sense to me. Can you please expound on this thought and how it relates to climate change?
Franklin, you want to talk? Go ahead and do it.
That's over my head. I don't know. I don't know what that means. The flood. Look, the climate's been changing forever. And my question is, if there is man-made climate change, why were there ice ages in the past and warm ages in the past when we didn't have human activity or CO2 emissions like we have now? In fact, I have a cousin that works at the UN in Geneva, and I was over there one time talking to him, and he said, Frank, don't you think that the U.S. ought to cut back emissions for climate change? And I said, well, as far as I've been told, and correct me if I'm wrong, the U.S. could cut its emissions to zero if, in fact, man-made climate change is a real thing. Could cut it to zero, and it would hardly have any impact on global temperatures because China and India and other developing countries will not reduce their global emissions. And the problem is, if you reduce global emissions, you're increasing poverty. Why? Because why is there global emissions? Because you're productive. And if you try and restrict them too much, now you're taking jobs and money and food out of people's mouths. So there's got to be a balance here.
I just want to point out something else about that discussion that's applicable in a lot of different areas. I noticed that the whole discussion about what is now called climate change used to be about global warming. Well, when you call it global warming, it's quantifiable. You could show that it's not warming or it is warming in any appreciable way. Why was the discussion changed to climate change? Because the climate's always changing in a certain sense. It's now difficult to quantify whether one side is right or one side is wrong. That strikes me as subterfuge, okay? It's a way of playing a rhetorical game to keep one side going strong, all right? That makes the whole thing suspicious to me. I'm not a scientist, I haven't looked at all the details, but that makes it suspicious. I also mentioned something earlier about a new term I've learned this weekend, and that is Castro consensus. And Castro consensus is when you get consensus and no disagreement is allowed. Well, you have now Castro consensus on climate change. And if you disagree, you're silenced, you're marginalized, you're told the debate is over, you're called names. Is this the right way to get to the truth? This is also a suspicious maneuver to me. So when I see people arguing any point in that way, I'm immediately suspicious of the point itself. Just an issue of rhetorical maneuvering that you want to be aware of. You know, Shakespeare wrote in one of his plays, "Methinks thou dost protest too much." Sometimes by the way people protest, you can get behind their protest and see what the truth that's really going on. And I think something like that is going on in the so-called climate change discussion.
I wish there was a citation of the actual movie that they were referring to, but so let me just go back to you, Greg. The Colombo tactic sounds like the Socratic method, and I've heard you say that taking off the roof tactic comes from Francis Schaeffer's work. Who else has influenced your development of tactics? Can you recommend any additional resources besides your books?
It is the Socratic method. I mean, it goes back 400 years before Christ. Socrates used this method. And so it's, in fact, when I was first thinking about kind of formalizing the approach to make it handy, memorable, transferable, I thought about Socrates. And I thought, well, maybe we can call this the Socratic. Okay, see, Jim's looking at me like this because he made me change the title of a book because my book original title was too stupid, and that's what he told me, so I changed it. And Socratic.
Don't you like the new title better?
No. It was.
Do you like the new title better?
It took me 60 seconds to be convinced, all right? So he was right about that, but he's given me that stink eye look again. And so, I mean, it's just the point, Socratic, that's dull. But Columbo, wow, isn't that fun? Now, I could have put on a robe and walked around like a But Columbo with a cigar, that's fun. So, you know, I'm just trying to find a particular handle, so to speak, that would make the information more applicable. Now, it turns out that taking the roof off is a maneuver of Francis Schaeffer's, and I learned from him for that particular tactic, but it also goes by another name, and that is reductio ad absurdum. So this has been in play. The idea of a self-refuting notion. Well, that's been in play a long time, and lots of people talk about that. And John Lennox talked about it the other night. I just gave it a name. I called it suicide. And that's more sticky, right? And so there's actually, I figured out there's probably four ways that an argument or a point of view can commit suicide, and I distinguish those. Just the facts, ma'am. Well, that comes from a TV show that some Nobody of you knows probably anymore. Have seen a long time ago, but back before even Columbo. But that phrase is meant to point out that the facts matter. Okay, and sometimes just looking at the facts, you solve a challenge against Christianity. So these are just things that I encountered in different places. It wasn't like there was one person that deeply influenced me on this. I was just picking up things here and there, but what I'm really trying hard to do is find ways of structuring it and organizing it so it's memorable and transferable. And that's really what was going on in most of those cases, yeah.
This probably affects all of us too. People of all faiths have common near-death experiences, NDEs. Does that mean that Christianity isn't the only path to salvation? I think you covered a little bit of that tonight already. But
could you read the first part of that?
People of all faiths have common near-death experiences. Does that mean that Christianity isn't the only path to salvation?
I think all near-death experiences show us is that there is a, it's another way of showing materialism is false, but it doesn't show which worldview is correct other than materialism's false. There is a spiritual realm because there are veridical, which means you can verify the fact that people are having remote viewing. You know, they'll go up over a hospital when they're on the table and say, I just saw an accident on 3rd and Main after the doctor brings them back, you know, and there was an accident on 3rd and Main, yet the guy was on the operating table the whole time. And Gary Habermas, who Mike has worked with quite a bit, has some books on this, but I don't think it proves one, whether it proves Christianity or Islam or any other worldview. It just shows that materialism, it's another reason we know materialism is false, that people can view, people can be somewhere else, yet their body can be in another location, so there is a spiritual realm.
By the way, those experiences are called remote viewing experiences, and they are evidential. Gary Habermas has done a lot of work on this, and he also is very careful to say that the NDEs do not prove any particular religious view, and sometimes the assessment of what people see is...
No, he didn't. No, he didn't say all of that. Now, I thought what you said was excellent.
Well, repetition is really good, isn't it? Sorry about that.
I was supposed to be his wingman tonight. I told him I'd be his wingman and help him out with all that. But here you are making, you know, thanks.
But I agree. I did catch the line or the point that what it does do is it really seems to put to bed the claims of materialism when you can have evidentially proven experiences that people, apart from their body, were in some other location gathering information that could be tested.
But one of the good things about this is, and Mike's like a brother to Gary.
No, he already said that.
No, I know. But that's a good place to go, because I think that Gary's done a lot of really good work kind of at podcasts. Most recently, he was on several YouTube interviews talking about NDEs. I mean, Gary's done a lot of kind of research on this. So I would just point you to Habermas, Gary Habermas, has done a lot of, I think some of the better work. If nothing else, just summarizing the work of others as he kind of talks about these. It's good stuff.
Lots of research that actually went into verifying these accounts.
He's
very,
and he's all off the top of his head, too. He knows it well enough to be able to pull it off the top of his head.
I just want to point out one other thing is that being hard of hearing and senile are two different things. Just so you know.
I'm not quite sure why you even brought the senile part up.
Okay. What is the relationship between knowing and believing? Carl Sagan said one time, I don't want to believe, I want to know. How does that relate to some of the things we're discussing this week?
Can I jump in?
Oh, can we stop you?
Before somebody says what I want to say, okay.
Respect your elders.
Knowledge is a subject.
There's only one elder up here. Respect your elder.
This is where precision in language is really important, okay? Knowledge is a subset of belief. Some people say, I don't believe it. I know it, okay? But they're using the word belief in that sense as mere belief, just an idea that something is so, and with no reason to believe it. I don't believe it. I know it. But knowledge classically characterized is called justified true belief. Justified true belief. So you have to believe something before you can know it. Knowledge is a subset of belief. It's those things that you believe are so and have good reasons to believe are so and actually are so, okay? So sometimes in this kind of question, I think the important thing to know is that everybody has beliefs. They all think they're true. But many of our beliefs we don't know are true because we don't have good enough evidence for it. Okay? We believe it, but we don't know it. That's different from somebody saying, well, you have your beliefs, but I have my knowledge, as if knowledge isn't a kind of belief. Well, knowledge is a subset of belief. They're just dismissing your mere leap of faith kind of beliefs. And what happened? Okay. They're just dismissing your, what they say, mere leap of faith kind of beliefs against their knowledge of something. But all knowledge entails belief.
This is one of the reasons why it's so important for us to think about what is a standard of proof. Like, what do we use as a standard of proof? Like, how, if you say you know, what you really they're getting at is, hey, I have an evidential basis for my knowledge. You just have a blind belief, unsubstantiated by any evidence, and that's the distinction they're trying to draw. Even though they may not be using the precise philosophical terms, right? So the question then becomes, well, okay, well, how much do I have to have evidentially before I can know something with this tricky word we use called certainty? So there is nothing that you know beyond a possible doubt. Anything that you think you know beyond a possible doubt, I can challenge in some way. We even have a jury instruction for this in the state of California. It's also true in Arizona and every other state. And that is that the standard is below possible doubt because for every claim, the judge will say, I can level a possible or imaginary doubt. So really the bar is so much lower. I don't want to have an unjustified belief. I always say that there's three kinds of belief. There's a blind belief for which I have no evidence. There is an unreasonable belief for which there is evidence to the contrary that I am trying to dismiss. And then there is a forensic belief, a belief that actually can be, a case can be made publicly for based on evidence. So I wrote this book called Forensic Faith to make the distinction that I don't want to have an unreasonable faith. I don't want to have...
conveniently a title of one of your books, right?
That's right. That's why I try to do that, right? You know, and I think I probably got that title from you. Or something like that. So, but the point is, we want to have beliefs that we can ground in some form of evidence, but make sure you understand that you are always going to have an unanswered question. And we ask that question of jurors. Are you the kind of person who can render a verdict even though you have unanswered questions? No, I don't think so. I think I need to have every question answered. Well, then you're excused. You're not getting on my jury because I'm never going to be able to answer every question. And so I that's just too high a bar. And this is also true for any theistic worldview. I mean, do you really think that you somehow, at the level of human, whose thoughts are as far away from God's as the stars are from Earth, right, like you just talked about, do you really think I'm going to be able to get to this without any questions? With a complete, absolute certainty where there's not a single unanswered question in my mind? Wow, you're an arrogant jerk, right? Because the reality is we're not going to be able to do that. And so we have to have a reasonable standard that is some, you know, is below. If you think you have to know every single detail about science before you can even have a discussion about science, then you have no discussions about anything.
There's another quick, helpful distinction, the distinction between belief that and belief in. Belief that is getting evidence that something is true, but trusting in it is then putting your trust in whatever you have good evidence to believe. For example, most of us got on planes to come here. We got evidence that the planes were safe, that the pilots are well trained, that ATC would get us here safely, but we really didn't trust in that evidence until we got on the plane. And we know this in relationships, right? When I first met my wife 35 years ago, I got evidence that she would be a good wife, but all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife, and in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. See, that's the difference between belief that and belief in. But faith does not mean you have no evidence. It means you are trusting in what you have good evidence to believe. That's what it means. You're trusting in what you have good evidence to believe. So don't buy into this idea that Christianity is blind faith. It's not. It's trusting in what you have good evidence to believe. But do you know that even the demons know that God exists, but they don't trust in him? James, the half-brother of Jesus, who wrote that little book in the New Testament called? Pastor, this is a sharp group, let me tell you. He says even the demons believe that God exists, but they tremble. They know intellectually better than we do that God exists, but they don't trust in him. So in order to have your moral transgressions forgiven, you have to go from belief that to belief in. Because God won't force you into heaven against your will. Sorry, go ahead.
That's good. Yeah, okay. All right. This question is primarily for Douglas Axe, but any of you can answer it.
He looks like Doug.
I'm going with that. Because of his recent book, The Price of Panic, but others are welcome to weigh in, part of the question. What does the current science or data say about COVID-19? Ooh. How should we as Christians and as citizens of the USA live our lives as a result of that data?
Science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. And that's why you get so many different opinions. The problem is we don't have enough data, and we have different standards from state to state, from hospital to hospital, on how we code for COVID deaths. That's why there's so much ambiguity. And you can read the book, The Price of Panic, or you can listen to the podcast I just had with Jay Richards. He's the co-author with Doug Axe, who was just here the other night, on that book. And they go through really what has happened over the past several months in the United States regarding this. And they don't deny there's COVID or any of that. They're just saying that really there's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of things were done improperly in their view. And they don't assign blame to anybody. They don't say somebody's to blame for this. They give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but they say if we had to do this again, knowing what we know now, we would sequester the vulnerable people and everybody else would be working.
I'll give you an example of how this has changed too. I mean, my son is a doctor and he's in Keck Hospital at USC in Los Angeles. And what he's talked about is how we've completely changed our treatment protocol, right? So there's some talk about, well, is hydroxychloroquine that, you know, a great treatment. He actually thinks it's Decadron. It's a steroid that probably is now the best option on the table for treating the disease. And we used to think, well, we need to intubate immediately and use ventilators, and now we've moved away from that as a treatment entirely. As a matter of fact, it's pretty much a sign if you've got to intubate somebody for a ventilator, they're probably not going to survive it. And just what happens is that the steroid is the best treatment because it actually decreases the amount of inflammation. It also restricts your immune system response. And it turns out the immune system response is what's really destructive to your lungs. So we're moving in, we're on our understanding. Now, if we'd have thought that or known that in the very beginning, we wouldn't have gone through, how many months did we go through at ventilator collection and treatment programs, and how many lives could have been saved? So it's really hard to say what the death rate would have been if we would have begun the treatment program in March using the protocols we have now in October. So hindsight's always 2020, right? So what you're seeing, for example, in the second spike in California, in the first spike, we had a death spike that kind of was lower, of course, but similar to the contagion spike. Well, now we have a contagion spike and no rise in the death spike because we just learned how to treat it. And so I think in the end, we look back at these things and we say, hey, they've changed their protocol for treatment of COVID completely.
Only 6% of people that have died from COVID, supposedly by the stats, really died from just COVID. 94% were comorbidities, and people that died had 2.6 on average comorbidities, and their average age was 79.4, according to. So the average age of death for a COVID patient is 79.4 in the United States. Yeah, it's higher than life expectancy, actually.
How I feel about it, too, is I'm always hesitant on any type of statistical speculation or formulation, because let's face it, we'll have great statistics 5 years from now when the entire thing's over and we have all the numbers. Until then, it's like a moving target. You know, how many are we being tested? Is it all a ratio of tests, and some states are testing more than others? Mm-hmm. There's so many ways, unfortunately, to misread the statistics. I just don't know how much confidence I have in trying to make a statistical case for this right now. Now, in the end, we'll be able to look back at it, and we'll know exactly how many got it, how many died of it, and we'll have a great statistical record. But while we're in the middle of it, I think we have to be very cautious about any of this analysis. That's just me.
We thought about taking that question out.
Yeah, I wish you would have taken that question out.
Okay, Mike, what was the potential error with the census of Caesar Augustus, I think that you referenced in your...
Yeah, that's in Luke's gospel, and it mentions that Caesar Augustus did a census throughout the Roman Empire, while Quirinius was the proconsul or governor of Syria. And we don't have evidence that he was proconsul of Syria during that time. He's listed as a proconsul at an earlier date. So that's, I mean, you can try to harmonize it. It's possible there's some things that, well, it, probably not harmonize it, but there's some possibilities in there. Maybe he was there another time and so forth. But it's still a reasonable candidate for an error. We just have to leave it at that.
Okay. Talking about the liberties John took with biography during the during your lecture, could the difference be rooted in how the Romans and Greeks did biography as opposed to the Jews?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a fair question, but for some reason, Jews did not want to write biographies of their sages during that period. We only have four from antiquity. Three are written by Philo, the life of Abraham, the life of Moses, and the life of, I can't remember right now. Moses, Abraham, and...
Josephus?
I'm thinking of Philo.
Oh, sorry.
So, and his life of Moses is his main one. Okay, and then you've got Josephus who writes a fourth one, but it's not an actual biography, it's an autobiography. And they use a lot of the same compositional devices that we find Plutarch and Suetonius and other biographers of that period. So there are, within, let's say, 150 years of Jesus, there are around 90 biographies of people that were written during that period. And that includes the four. That includes the four Jewish biographies that I was just mentioning, but they are all very common. So, and again, Jews didn't, for some reason, didn't want to write those biographies. After those four in the first century, we don't get the first Jewish biography until modern times. So they all follow these same kind of literary conventions. So if you don't like, you know, the idea of Greco-Roman biography, just call it ancient biography. But John seems to follow a lot of those. But John does things differently than Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. I encourage you, just read Matthew 5 times, then Mark 5 times, then Luke 5 times, and then read John 5 times. Read them. You don't have to read them in order. I'd read Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You can read those in any order. But I'd read just 5 times and 5 times and 5 times, and then read John 5 times. And you'll notice that even though Jesus teaches the same sort of things, he sounds a lot differently. He sounds a lot like John does in 1 John, if you read 1 John 5 times. So there are a lot of differences. And Craig Keener, who's a specialist in John, he said that all scholars who specialized in the Johannine literature recognize Johannine adaptation. In other words, John is adapting these teachings. Most Johannine specialists think that John has taken Jesus' teachings. He's already got Matthew, Mark, and Luke down. He's probably familiar with those. And rather than just doing another repetition, because these three are so similar, John decides to do things a little differently. And so he takes Jesus' teachings and he paraphrases them and recasts them in his own words. And he takes some more liberties than the others do, probably with the speeches, the discourses of Jesus. And Johannine specialists try to figure out all that John is doing, and it's enigmatic. The conservative New Testament scholar N.T. Wright has a really great statement. He says, "I feel about John like I feel about my wife. I love her very much, but I don't claim to understand her." And even such a conservative scholar as F.F. Bruce said that John has taken Jesus' words and he has recast them as an expanded paraphrase, a translation of the freest kind, a transposition into another key, and so much more. So it's just, John is enigmatic. He still follows a lot of the biographical conventions of that day, but he does does things a little bit differently, and it confuses.
I'm going to throw something into this just as something to consider. When I get called out in the middle of the night for a homicide, they only ask the dispatcher to do one thing. Have the officers on the scene separate the eyewitnesses. And I do that for a reason. Because if I don't separate those eyewitnesses when I get there, five or six people who saw this just 2 hours ago will tell me the same story because they've had a chance to talk to each other. Real eyewitness accounts are very, very, very different if it just happened 2 hours ago. And this is very true for 30-year-old cases. Because I'll get, what typically happens, we have a homicide, I'll tell my team, can you five guys do the neighborhood for me, please? I'm gonna talk to these two witnesses. They'll canvas the neighborhood and they'll find four or five people on the neighborhood who also saw it, and they'll take a statement. If I stop right there and I never go back and re-interview their guys, I'm gonna have a problem in trial because the statements are so utterly different. And they just saw this 2 hours ago. This is the nature of eyewitness statements. And the order in which you take eyewitness statements often determines why they're different. So when I interview people, if I'm interviewing these people, they've been separated, they will tell me, what intrigued me about the Gospels as an investigator was that they were so different. Because I saw that texture, and it's as much an art as it is in science, I'll just tell you that up front. But I saw the texture of the differences, and I thought to myself, ooh, this is gonna provoke me to study a little more because this feels like an eyewitness account in the sense that it had the same level of variation. Now I'll tell you, there are times when I can't get back to the witness because it's now been 35 years, that dude's dead. And the person who wrote the supplemental report is now also dead. So now I have no access to the eyewitness or the person who wrote the report about the eyewitness. What do? I can't go back and re-interview and say, hey, you know what, you said this different than this guy did. Tell me, or not even just to say that, just say, tell it to me again and try to prompt out and resolve the difference. I can't do that. But every time we do, we are able to do that. It's amazing what we'll discover. So you'll see something like for Quirinius. How do we resolve this problem? It seems like there's an error. And this happens in eyewitness accounts. You know, like there's no way this is gonna kill us in trial, but the defense team is gonna make a huge deal out of this. But then when you actually get him and talk to him, you realize there's something that happened 30 years ago that I still have access to, but sometimes you don't have access to it. Just because I know after talking to thousands and thousands of eyewitnesses who never ever agree. And I used to do this exercise in front of people where I just have something happen and interview all five of these people and they tell you five different things. So you can demonstrate it. That it doesn't bother me. And I don't know, I mean, perhaps it is true that this is a biographical, this is a genre of literature that gives people liberty to kind of change things. But I think what you're all wondering is, so you're telling me, if I was to go back in time, John's account would not actually capture what Jesus said. And I'm telling you that when you go back in time to the eyewitnesses in my trials, they all capture what happened, but they capture it from different perspectives. It's not always different geographic perspectives in the room. Like I'm standing over here, so I saw that and you didn't see it. It's the, hey, I never ask a guy, what was the suspect wearing? I ask the girls that. I just do. Because the guy will say, I don't know, polo shirt? Girls are like, no, it was a Tigre shirt. And it had the band, the strap on the side that has like elastic. And the collar was floppy. Guys don't notice those kinds of things. But gals do. And so the descriptions sometimes are like a white t-shirt versus a blue polo shirt with all this detail. And how do I determine what? Well, it turns out that neither one is lying to you. And there's a way to reconcile these two eyewitness accounts. And we're going to have to do that before we go to trial because trust me, the defense team's going to attack that.
You know, the differences that you mentioned, though, between variations and eyewitnesses, that can work between, let's say, the synoptics and John or Mark and John. But that doesn't work so well when we're looking at differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. When I did my 8-year focused study on gospel differences, at the end, what really impresses you are not the differences, but the similarities with the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Because the way I'd explain it is this. If, let's say, the five of us are at a restaurant and we're having dinner, and we notice a couple at the table next to us and they're having an argument, and we're watching that argument intensify over the course of 10 minutes, and finally the couple stand up and they're yelling at each other, and the woman takes a wine bottle and breaks it across the guy's cheek, and just then the paramedics, the police come, they arrest the woman, take her off in cuffs, the paramedics work on the guy's face,
police officer comes over and asks the five of us at that moment to report, write down independently what we saw and what we heard. Like you say, there's going to be variation in eyewitness testimony. There's going to be a lot of similarities. There's going to be a lot of differences. Mm-hmm. Now, if the police officer gets those back and he looks and sees there's virtually verbatim, word for word, in many of those instances, that police officer is going to know, be suspicious that there was collusion involved, collaboration involved. But there's more. Mm-hmm. That couple was arguing in Spanish. Now, fortunately, we're all fluent in Spanish. Mm-hmm. But the police officer is not. So the police officer asks us to translate that into English. Mm-hmm. Now, anyone who's remotely familiar with another language knows that there's no one-on-one correspondence in translations. And even you'll translate something differently tomorrow than you translated today.
Sure.
But when they get it back and they see that there's still a one-to-one correspondence in many cases, word for word, in our translation of what was said and done, the police officer all the more is going to be suspicious that we have colluded with one another. But there's still more. Because it's not just 20 minutes later that we're doing this, it's 30, 40 or more years later that we're recalling those things, word for word translated. Now the police officer is rightly going to know that we worked with one another on this. With the Gospels, you've got Jesus mainly speaking in Aramaic. It's been translated into Greek. Right. It's almost word for word in the report in a minimum of 20 years later.
Right.
So whereas you could have that independent testimony between John and, let's say, Mark, you're not, it's going to be more difficult to establish that between Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Okay, so you're saying, like, as a police officer, well, I'm going to give you, as a police officer, because I happen to be a police officer. So I'm just saying, if I was to take a crime that occurred last week, and it was a 20-minute thing, and so you each write 10 pages on what happened, and I don't tell you that that's an, and I present it to you instead as an ancient document, you will see all the things that we try to harmonize, that we either try to harmonize or explain away through genre, you will see in the event from just last week. I think what you're wondering is, can I have any confidence that that event actually occurred and that I can reconstruct the event reasonably given the data? And my fear is that if we aren't careful, that we could find the cases I'm working, if I gave those to you and told you they were 3,000 years old, you would be tempted to figure out how to explain the differences by way of some genre or anything else, because they are hard to reconcile. There will be places where they agree word for word. I don't think that necessarily, one of two things happened. They either made it up together, those pieces word for word, but if they're sprinkled without along the way with differences, but some things are similar, I'm also could be that they just happen to hear those things accurately. And they represented them accurately. So my thinking on it is a question you probably all have is, can we trust that what we have are four documents that are even reconcilable, or that we have to kind of guess where authors took liberty with the facts? And so all I'm saying to you is, if you took those four eyewitness accounts from 2 hours ago, you would think perhaps somebody is taking liberty with the facts, when in reality, they all are just reporting accurately what they saw. We have to figure out, my job is to reconcile those differences before we get to trial. And sometimes you can do it because you can interview people and get those things reconciled, but sometimes you can't. And it's an open question. And then, but I don't necessarily jump to, well, you're colluding, or are you even changing the facts? Because I know enough about eyewitness accounts to know that these things can still be true. Yeah, there are these things we try to reconcile later. So that's why I'm always hesitant to jump to something other than, wow, this is just the nature of eyewitness accounts.
Okay, but you also say about changing the facts, and I want to be clear about something like that. You also mentioned the difference between men and women, what they're going to report, and how women are going to,
yes,
you're going to ask them about dress.
Yes.
There is, as any married person in here knows, there's a difference between the guy version of a story and the girl version of the story, right? Because women like all those details, and men, we just like bullet points, get to the bottom line, the game's coming on.
Yeah.
And so guys will adapt the story. We will abbreviate it. We will change some details. We do it intentionally because the person we're talking to isn't interested in all this background knowledge that women will tell, because they've got to tell every fact as it happened. We will say things differently because the other person doesn't care. So us guys will talk to a friend on the phone, and our wives are in the background saying,
hey, could you get to the bottom line? Come on.
Right?
Get to the bottom line, will you?
That's right. So we will change things, but we aren't doing it to corrupt the truth, all right? And it's not like we're telling this to a detective or a police officer because a crime has been committed. We're talking about the recounting of history.
Yeah, no, I just, all I'm saying is that witnesses do the exact same thing. Every witness edits. And you have to actually prompt out what you think they're editing. And that's very true, is that witnesses will do that to you. They will edit. Because they want, also, they don't want to be stuck here any longer either. Let me just give you what I can give you so I can get the heck out of here. So people will edit, and you've got to kind of figure out how to prompt that. All I'm saying is there's two ways to read that. One is, quite possibly, this is just how eyewitnesses operate.
You know, I think sometimes when Christians hear these discussions, they get a little confused about the notion of inspiration, and they think, well, if that was the inspired word, and why is it different from what that other person then recorded? Our doctrine of inspiration has to do with the writings. In other words, the writings that were delivered by the inspired writers, even if they sum things up in a little different way, our doctrine of inspiration is that God was working through the writers to produce a particular writing that was God-breathed. All scripture, all graphe is inspired. Thank you. So it's not inconsistent with what's just been discussed here. I just don't want you to get confused about that. God uses all kinds of people and all kinds of circumstances and all kinds of literature to communicate his truth. It's the writings themselves that are inspired, even when they have general differences about really non-essentials.
Well, I would say it this way. If God wanted to give us a document that we could then look at from the lens of eyewitness accounts and eyewitness statements, and it would have all of the characteristics of eyewitness accounts, even that we see today, he did a good job. It was inspired because we now have, you can test it as an eyewitness account, and it passes the test, even though there are great variations in certain parts of the accounts, which is absolutely typical with every eyewitness account, regardless of how old it is.
I think for the sake of time, I just want to segue a little bit off of John. Can you speak for a minute to the theological telegraphing that John does when it comes to the Old Testament scriptures? Like, for instance, John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God.
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk about things that's in my lane, and I'm honestly not a Johannine specialist, so okay. I'm not going to comment on that.
I think in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
What he said.
Exactly.
Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I actually didn't even understand the question, but I just thought I'd throw it out.
Greg and I love that passage because it's a great passage that kind of speaks to the deity of Christ, and it's a great Jehovah's Witness kind of passage. I remember when I first started studying, I was listening to you as an atheist on Stand to Reason back in the day. I thought, wow, you know, I didn't realize that you could be reasonable about this belief system. And although I was not ready to believe it was true, it did open the door that, you know, this is a worldview that might be intellectually satisfying. So it didn't stumble me. What was great about Greg's work is that it opens the door for a lot of us, and it's been doing it for a lot of years. And then ultimately I get to meet the dude, and then now here we are years later. I'm making sure he hears the questions.
That's why he kisses me.
That's right.
Well, I think we're out of time, and I know all of you guys have great resources. So look them up if you're interested in more of the resources that they have online on their websites, podcasts, cross-examined. Yours is questions?
Yeah, well, str.org, Stand to Reason. Stand to Reason. Get everything for it. I did run into somebody earlier today. I was surprised to find out that I was with Stand to Reason. So apparently we haven't made that as obvious as we need to. Stand to Reason, str.org.
So lots of stuff still available. Thank you. I thank you guys very much
for having
doing
us.
This.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming out here this weekend. Great stuff. And I think that's going to wrap our time together. Enjoy your evening, what's left of it.
All right. Thank you.
And are you guys going to be...
You got books at the book table?
I don't know. Do I?
I don't know. I'm going down there.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I'm going to go to the book table right now.
Stuff that's set up here. I could
go to the book table?
I'm sorry.
Let's go to the book table.